I'm sure a number of you have wondered why I looked straight through you, and that is because I always forget a name and never remember a face. This is something I have to live with. On election day, I arrived at the polling place, and there's some ladies at the registration table, and one said, "Sam Taylor, hello." I didn't have the foggiest. And I said, "It's so nice to see you again. Let's see, where did we meet?" And she says, "Always kidding. I sat next to you at the California Writers Club dinner last night." Well, I have a brother-in-law with the same problem. He's a physician in Sacramento, obstetrics. And, of course, when the nurse brings in a patient, he has already examined her record, so he greets her by the first name, asks about the husband and the kiddies, tells her the joke of the day, a very warm relationship. But in the street, he's a hunted animal because he can't remember who's who. And if he sees a patient approaching, he either goes the other way or scoots across the street to avoid her. And he was in a bank, waiting in line, and the lady ahead of him looked around and said, "Max, long time no see." And he says, "How wonderful to see you again. Let's see, your name's on the tip of my tongue." And she says, "It's Gene. Remember, you and I used to be married." Oh, say, what is truth? 'Tis the rarest gem that connivers of myth do produce. And priceless the value of truth if and when their proud contrived tales are shown once again to be counted but dross and refuse. While I yield to no man in my reverence for and admiration of our pioneer church authorities, let us face the fact that they weren't historians. Their account of events was to convince and convert rather than to inform. On some important matters, they went on record with statements which directly were opposite of the truth. One example. John Taylor wrote a popular missionary tract in 1850 about his debate at Boulogne-sur-Mer, France, with three Protestant ministers. With indignation and outrage, he declared, "We are accused here of polygamy and actions the most indelicate, obscene, and disgusting, such that none but a corrupt and depraved heart could have contrived. Such falsehoods," he said, "are too outrageous to admit of belief." And in refutation, he read the official church policy regarding marriage, DNC 101 at that time, which said that all marriages should be solemnized in a public meeting and that one man should have but one wife and one woman but one husband. The problem with this ringing defense of the faith was at that time John Taylor had at least 10 wives. The exact number is still uncertain. Yet I wouldn't want to call my grandfather a barefaced liar. Not at all. He was obeying a higher law in denying the facts. Joseph Smith had said, "O ye 12 and all saints, profit by this important key, that in all your trials, troubles, and tribulations," should that be tied to me or what? "Affliction, bonds, imprisonments, and death, see to it that you do not betray your brethren. Whatever you do, do not betray your friends." And in 1850, plural marriage was still officially a secret practice. In the Army, we were periodically lined up to hear the ARs read, the Army regulations, which were the facts of military life. The ARs stressed that if taken prisoner, we were to give the enemy our name, rank, and serial number, nothing more. Any more information was treason, for which the penalty was death. Treason wasn't telling lies, but telling the truth to the enemy. This brings up a basic fact of our official Mormon history. The saints were at war with the outside world for approximately a full century. Our official account of events during this period really isn't accurate history at all. Instead, it is typical war propaganda, complete with the customary atrocity stories, which we call persecution. This propaganda is strictly one side of a highly controversial conflict. The other side has been rejected or suppressed. Instead of recognizing the conflict as being between a basically good people, the saints, and their basically good neighbors, with each side adequately motivated, our propaganda casts the conflict in the classic pattern of a struggle between good and evil. The saints were completely blameless. Their neighbors were evil mobbers, mad dogs, human fiends. Yes, there were outrages, but war is hell. Each side committed excesses. As an Air Force correspondent with the Public Relations Office of the Strategic Air Forces in Europe, I was fully aware of the difficulty of telling the simple truth about the war. Our office was committed to telling the truth, but S2, intelligence, the censors wanted only propaganda. One story I wrote was so true that an MP with a gun on his hip arrived to confiscate it. It was a court-martial offense to mention radar, although the enemy not only knew about it, but had adopted our system in preference to theirs. As a kid, I thrilled at the movies during World War I. The Kaiser, the Beast of Berlin, the Unpardonable Sin, to hell with the Kaiser. We firmly believed that spies were loading our cornflakes with ground glass, and that German soldiers, Huns, spent much of their time cutting off the breasts of Belgian girls. Well, with the passage of time, we have an objective history of World War I, of World War II, and of the Civil War. However, our official propaganda about the 100-year war between the saints and the outside world has changed very little, for the reason that it deals with and is told by sainted pioneer figures who all serve were inspired religious leaders. An attempt to alter the story is at best carping criticism, at worst apostasy. Yet I wonder how many converts enter the front door with stars in their eyes and creep out the back door upon stumbling over one single untruth. And no venom can match the implacable animosity of a disillusioned convert. Church Information Service made a motion picture about Pioneer Nauvoo for showing at the visitor center there. T. Edgar Lyon, who had a vast knowledge of Nauvoo history, told me that this film contained 84 errors of fact. When you can be wrong 84 times in a half hour, you really are dedicated to mythology. How many converts are made from a film that contains 84 stumbling blocks? In police work, a case often is broken when a member of a group turns state's evidence and tells the truth. Yet any testimony contrary to our official history is rejected as apostate lies. We ignore Senate Document 189, regarding Danite activities. I have never seen John C. Bennett's book, The History of the Saints, or an expose of Joe Smith and Mormonism, used as documentation for events at Nauvoo. Yet regardless of his serious character defects, a bisexual and an abortionist who took care of what he called celestial consequences, and despite the fact that he wrote with venom and destroyed his own integrity in his book, despite this, Bennett had been assistant president of the church, next in authority to Joseph Smith. He had been mayor of Nauvoo. He did know the inside facts of what went on. Other important books by insiders, such as T.B. Stenhouse's Rocky Mountain Saints and Frank J. Cannon's Under the Prophet in Utah, are also largely rejected. Yet it was the reading of Stenhouse's book that first motivated me to begin research in LDS history. He had no love for early church leaders, but he did give dimension and character to men who had been portrayed as cardboard stereotypes. Despite his bias, they came through as heroic figures. Cannon's book is invaluable for its inside look at high-level decisions, in particular, his eyewitness account of the meeting at which the Woodruff Manifesto of 1890 was approved. Today, the virulent attacks on Mormonism and its leaders by Gerald and Sandra Tanner's Utah Lighthouse Mystery Ministry, Knee Modern Microfilm, which has continued with crusading zeal since 1964, has been ignored as beneath contempt. Ironically enough, their diligence in digging up documents pertaining to early LDS history, making them available via the Salt Lake Samizdat, has proved a veritable gold mine to scholars and historians. T. Edgar Lyon told me that, in his opinion, the church should subsidize them for their efforts. And surprisingly, in their zeal for truth, the Tanners were among the very first to blow the whistle on Mark Hoffman, the forger, bomber, and consummate con artist. I've wondered if the bomb which exploded in his lap was intended for them. Another likely victim is Brent Ashworth, a collector of early documents, who also blew the whistle early. Ashworth told me he might have been the victim, except that he missed an appointment with Hoffman by 10 minutes. The true story of plural marriage has never been officially told. The body of evidence presented in the magazine Truth month after month for 20 years was not only rejected, but Salt Lake tried to stop publication on the grounds that quotations from early prophets was pornographic literature. The entire issue of Dialogue, spring 1985, was devoted to D. Michael Quinn's article, The Church Authority and the New Plural Marriage, 1890-1904. Yet despite 97 pages and 383 footnotes, the article omits a vital aspect of the practice during that period. Richard S. Van Wagner's book, Mormon Polygamy, A History, 1986, omits the same material, despite its 370 pages and a total of 188 extensive footnotes occupying 42 pages. Nor can it be found in James R. Clark's five-volume Messages of the First Presidency. Just what is it that was too sensitive to mention? And why was it verboten? The awful and unutterable truth that even the new Mormon history cannot utter is that plural marriage went underground with official sanction, again in Utah, as it had been in Kirtland, Missouri, Nauvoo, and previously in Utah until 1852. John Taylor set up the apparatus. In 1882, he issued an epistle on marriage, which authorized marriages with endowments outside the endowment house and temple. 2 years later, Taylor testified under oath during the trial of Rudger Clausen that he had set apart hundreds of men with authority to perform such marriages at any place convenient. This was called the Grand Conspiracy. Then, while on the underground in 1886, Taylor received a revelation that the law of God would never change, and those who would enter my glory must and shall obey my law. When the Wilford Manifesto of 1890 was issued, it meant that the church had suspended the practice, but the priesthood authority already had taken it underground. The grand conspiracy continued for decades as one manifesto followed another, about a dozen, until the final one in 1933. Although John Taylor had stated that it was the authority of the marriage ceremony that counted, not the place where it occurred, stating that he himself had received endowments while crossing the plains when marrying Anna Ballantyne, and that he knew of many other such cases. Such is not the official attitude today. The entire subject is stonewalled. When the Colville Tabernacle was demolished, the reason given for the destruction of this pioneer architectural gem ignored the actual cause. The real reason was that it contained evidence of having been used for the performance of temple marriages. It had to go. Without question, marriages with endowments were performed outside the endowment house and temple during Brigham Young's time as well. Alice S. Royer's unflinchingly candid book, The True Believers, concerning the life of her great-grandfather Henry Lunt, who was Bishop of Cedar City, indicates that he married only the last of his four wives in the temple. Thank you. Lunt's journal records his marriage to his second, Marianne Wilson, with whom he had fallen in love while on a mission to England. He records he went by appointment to President Young's office, and he conducted me upstairs into a very nice room and sealed Marianne Wilson to me for time and eternity. I thanked him and gave him $5, which he accepted. He then took my hand in both of his and made me a present of the same $5 and said, God bless you. We never have faced the facts leading to the fall of Nauvoo. The saints of the time believed that this place would be the center stake of Zion until the millennium. The temple being not merely the house of the Lord, but Christ's actual abode at the second coming. However, it seems quite obvious to me that from the previous experience of the saints at other locations, that Nauvoo was doomed from the beginning. The people simply couldn't get along with their neighbors anywhere. After being expelled from a half dozen places previously, it was inevitable that conflict would arise at Nauvoo from the same causes, and that the Mormons would be forced to leave Illinois. One of the cherished fictions of our history is that all church authorities dearly love one another. Well, strong men can have strong differences of opinion, strong likes and dislikes. The personality clash between Brigham Young and John Taylor had an important bearing on the course of church history. In one instance, it is possible that except for this antagonism, the pioneer effort to found the beet sugar industry in Utah would have been a great success instead of being stymied for a period of 40 years. While on a mission to France, John Taylor investigated the beet sugar industry, which had thrived in Europe for a period of some 35 years, but hadn't crossed the Atlantic. He was apparently given full details of its manufacture, actually several minor but essential steps were not disclosed. He hired expert sugar people to erect and operate the plant organized a company, secured financing, had machinery made, shipped it and beet seed to Utah, but the factory he established failed to make sugar. Brigham took the project away from him, but his factory failed also. Taylor's experts, without doubt, made sure of it. European sugar makers obviously didn't want American competition. Wars had been fought over sugar. And so, what if Taylor and Brigham had faced the fact that they had been gulled? What if they had achieved success with the most important weapon, the gospel? What if the missionary effort in Europe had been focused on converting men in beet sugar factories? No emotion can equal the zeal of a born-again convert. His loyalty then is to the church, not to the sugar cartel. Just one single convert with know-how could have made the Pioneer Project a great success. But this wasn't done, and a total of 14 more attempts to make beet sugar in America failed over a period of 40 years before the secret crossed the Atlantic. Other examples of damaging strife include the feud between the prophet's widow, Emma Smith, and Brigham Young. We now know Emma as the elect lady, but it took many years for her to attain this status. There was a clash between the prophet's only remaining brother, William Smith, and Brigham Young. What might have happened if William hadn't been driven from Nauvoo? I've wondered if it was really necessary for Oliver Cowdery, David Whitmer, and Martin Harris, the three witnesses to the Book of Mormon, to be cast out and castigated. Other men also were delivered unto the buffetings of Satan. Sidney Rigdon, John C. Bennett, Orson Hyde, Orson Pratt, Thomas March, William McClellan, Luke Johnson, John Boynton, Lyman White, Sam Brannan, John D. Lee. The list is a long one, and the church history has changed thereby. Oliver Cowdery was second elder to Joseph Smith. Yet when cast out, he was charged with being united with a gang of counterfeiters, thieves, liars, and blacklegs of the deepest dye to deceive, cheat, and defraud the saints. Such accusations came to national attention, resulting in a senatorial investigation. If such a person was so black a character, what did it imply concerning his former confreres? Senate Document 189 changed the nation's attitude. The saints were no longer seen as a persecuted sect, but as a gang of terrorists. Thomas B. Marsh was president of the 12 when he stomped off in a snit over the strippings of a cow. Except for this, Brigham Young wouldn't have succeeded him. If Orson Hyde hadn't fallen from grace, then been restored to the 12 as of the date of reinstatement, John Taylor wouldn't have attained the presidency. John C. Bennett actually was a most capable man, one who did yeoman service for the saints. He walked the Nauvoo Charter through the Illinois legislature, giving that town the status of a city-state and with its own courts and judges, its own militia. He drilled the Nauvoo Legion into a crack company much larger than that of the state. A physician, he had introduced quinine in Nauvoo as a specific for the malaria, which had killed half the population the first summer. After breaking with Joseph, it was agreed that he would be allowed to leave quietly. Joseph recorded, "I have permitted General Bennett to withdraw his membership from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints this 17th day of May 1842, the best of feelings subsisting between all parties. However, when subsequently denounced, Bennett fought back most effectively with a series of letters in the San Gamo Journal, which became the basis of his book, History of the Saints. He joined Governor Boggs in Missouri in trying to entrap Joseph and take him across the river to be hanged. He embarked on a lecture tour. All in all, he did incalculable damage to the saints, and it really hadn't been at all necessary. His book is still extant in photo reproduction, available for $7, still an effective tool against the saints. Some years ago, David C. Martin began offering Xerox copies of early documents pertaining to Mormonism, and I obtained some valuable materials from him. Then he suddenly was out of business, having been warned that to continue would endanger his church membership. Just what, I wonder, are we afraid of? What are we trying to hide, and why? Can we assume that our missionary story is threatened by documentary evidence? Certainly none of the materials I obtained from Martin endangered my faith. Is truth, I wonder, an endangered species? I was happy to see an article in the Ensign, May 1983, Assembly Hall is rededicated, but surprised at the misinformation it contained. And so, leveling my broken lance, I tilted at the windmill with a letter to the editor. Brigham Young and Heber C. Kimball had absolutely nothing to do with the concept, design, or construction, both being dead. If Kimball delivered an address in the hall, it was in spirit form, because he had been dead more than 20 years at the time of his dedication. Certainly, I am not criticizing the brethren who spoke for not being historians. They have other and more important callings. But Fuhrer Magazine, to publish misinformation, what is the currency of your editorial content? I wonder why there was no mention at all of John Taylor, under whose direction the hall was designed and constructed. His name does not appear in the article. It would seem that a correction should be published. Needless to say, my carping criticism was ignored. I did think, however, at the very least, they might have mentioned the faith-promoting circumstance of the ghost of Heber G. Kimball having been on deck. The Achilles heel of a managed history is that it can only suppress. It cannot foster good literature. In fact, when Mormon authors fear and tremble for the law, and nobody knows what the law is, the resulting product is mediocrity. some years ago, I attended a meeting of the BYU Motion Picture Studio where we discussed a film about Joseph Smith. It was a film designed for national theater distribution, not just among the saints. Person after person says, "We've got to do more research, get more material." I said, "We don't need more material. We've got 10 times the material we can use. Our problem is selection." But I was alone. And now, some 30 years later, they're still getting more material, I suppose. Quite obviously, they were afraid to touch the subject. I wondered about Joseph's statement that sometimes he spoke as a prophet and other times as a man. I personally don't recall a single instance in the official history when he spoke merely as a man. But he must have been when he said that the moon was inhabited by a race of people who dressed like Quakers and lived to be 1,000 years old. This statement, however, isn't in the official history. He also admitted that some of his revelations were of God, some were of man, and some were of the devil. Must I assume that this is the reason why more than half of them haven't yet been given to the membership? I'd really like to know just what they said and who assumed the responsibility for the sorting. If even Joseph Smith's revelations were of 3 types, what about those of subsequent prophets, seers, and revelators? Were none of them of man or the devil? Are we to assume that later prophets were superior to Joseph? Every single one of us makes mistakes. I cringe at the whoppers I've been guilty of. We are counseled that if we make a mistake, we should confess and repent. Does that advice apply only to carping critics such as myself? Is it a matter of do as we say and not as we do? If later prophets goofed, what examples do we have? Yes, it is true that some words were eaten following the revelation that blacks were to receive the priesthood, but offhand I can't recall another instance. I remember when Franklin D. Roosevelt, looking back over his administration, frankly admitted a mistake. That was when he changed the date of Thanksgiving Day. So he repented it and changed it back. Everything else he did was okay. Ben Rich told my father that he knew the church was true. Otherwise, it never could have survived the damn mistakes that had been made. I've wondered why we don't celebrate the 23rd of December in Deseret rather than the 24th of July. Well, 24 July is the date that Brigham Young's Pioneer Party arrived in the Salt Lake Valley. Is that the thing above all we should commemorate? The Pioneer Party didn't settle the valley. It returned to winter quarters. The Taylor Pratt Company, which followed with the actual pioneer settlers, who knows the date they arrived? 5 October. Joseph Smith was born 23 December, but doesn't that matter? Shouldn't we at least give nodding acknowledgments during the Christmas holidays? Finally, in this tirade of carping criticism, I wonder why we are so uptight about change. I wonder what would be the necessity for continual revelation if everything was supposed to remain exactly as it had been. You'll be amazed, I'm sure, to learn that Salt Lake has never asked my advice nor profited by my counsel. So in the final analysis, I believe the situation fits my brother Raymond's definition of a Jack Mormon. He said a Jack Mormon was a seagull who wouldn't eat crickets. When my sister Lillian was called to testify in a court case, she was sworn to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. She then asked, "Your Honor, are the lawyers on both sides sworn in?" "No." "Are you sworn in?" "No." "Well, by hell and by damn," she cried, "only us peasants have to tell the truth."
Repeating a lyric that you've just heard, "Oh, say what is truth, 'tis the rarest gem that connivers of myth do produce." Sam Taylor's play on lyrics is supported, I think, by my journalistic expose of Paul Dunn's mythological stories. Sam today declined to call his grandfather a barefaced liar. He said John Taylor was merely obeying a higher law in denying the facts. Is there a higher moral law, a sort of license to lie that justifies lying for the Lord? Or are spiritual liars merely acting in self-interest rather than God's interest, promoting their own agendas or saving their own skins? When Sam heard that I drew the assignment to comment on his speech, he sent me a note and a copy of a letter he had written in Dialogue magazine. The letter was sent to set the record straight. An article incorrectly had said Taylor won the Medal of Honor during World War II. In truth, it was the Legion of Merit. The P.S. at the bottom of his letter to the editor read, "Egad, I don't want to be undone for my myth deeds, nor strung up for my Stringfellow stories." I am not an ethical absolutist. There are black lies and white lies. But when the church lied about polygamy, was it white or black? When Paul Dunn lied about his war and baseball experiences, were they white lies to motivate his audiences, or black lies to advance his popularity? "My motives are pure and innocent," Paul Dunn told the Arizona Republic. Now, Dunn knows his own motives best. I could only guess. What journalists can do is unearth the facts so that news consumers can evaluate motive, making up their own minds. When the Arizona Republic interviewed Paul Dunn, he admitted changing names, combining events, and adding emphasis to his personal stories, although he denied fabricating. When I first caught Dunn with his hand in the cookie jar, he did not admit combining, adding, or changing. He denied and stonewalled. For example, through his attorney, he produced falsified documents to prove he really had a professional baseball career. This document, the W-2 tax withholding form, and I've photo-enlarged it so you can see it just a little bit better, was supposed to prove Dunn played a season with the Ontario, California Orioles, a professional minor league club. Numbers are obviously hand-altered. One typewriter was used for wages and another one for tax withheld. It's like counterfeiting a $1,000 bill using a $1 bill and a crayon. My research about this form was part of the story I sold the Arizona Republic. A couple of days before the Republic interviewed Dunn, he was leaked some of my documentation. In the face of that overwhelming proof against the W-2, He then admitted he was cut by the Orioles and that the earnings, $5,024.75, were not paid by the Orioles. I wasn't paid that amount, so it should have to be some grouping, Dunn told the Republic. He explained he took money he earned from playing semi-professional baseball and grouped those earnings. The facts, though, show Dunn could not have earned anywhere near that amount playing so-called semi-pro ball. The most I could document players got was perhaps a Coke and a hot dog for each game. The Republic had an admission Dunn had falsified a document. That's a scoop. But nothing about Dunn using false documents appeared in the article. The Republic soft-pedaled the story. This W-2 form is being seen by the public for the first time today. Why did the Republic tone down the Dunn story? Journalistic reasons, partly. They saw the Dunn controversy as primarily a Utah story. Pressure may also have played a role. While the Republic was preparing the Dunn piece, there was an organized lobby against it. The Republic told me the lobbyists were Mormon leaders in the Phoenix area, with at least one Mormon sports figure, former Dallas Cowboys quarterback Danny White, who was involved with Dunn in a business venture. In Utah, Dunn was aided by his two strongest defenders in the controversy, Richard Iyer and James Jardine. Both have high church and political profiles. His attorney, Jim Jardine, is an LDS regional representative, a member of the University of Utah Board of Trustees. Richard Iyer, mission president, host of the LDS Church's Families Are Forever television show, and a possible candidate for governor. Despite the pressure against publication, the Republic broke a watered-down Dunn story. Upon publication, I expected his allies to continue their defense of Dunn and their attack on my journalistic enterprise. However, I did not anticipate Dunn would get additional support from BYU and the church itself. The church and BYU, with the cat finally out of the bag, should have condemned Dunn's storytelling, and BYU should have apologized for threatening my job in connection with the story. At the very least, I would have expected that they had remained neutral, siding neither with the expose nor with Dunn's myth-making. I was very unpleasantly surprised when both sided with Paul Dunn. In Germany, the day after the story broke, I got a fax from the Arizona Republic. It said, "I've heard that the church didn't waste any time setting up you as the bad guy." Instead of scurrying from the Paul Dunn ship, spokesmen for the church and BYU hopped on the Paul Dunn bandwagon. Instead of defending the faith, the spokesmen were defending the myth. Because the church and BYU did not remain neutral, I was simply outgunned. And not just by the sheer number of those speaking against the story, but by their tactics as well. Spokesmen for both BYU and the church told falsehoods. For example, in an interview with the Provo Daily Herald, BYU accused me of using the threat of breaking the story as a lever to keep my job at the Y. That's absolutely untrue. The truth is exactly the opposite. Paul Dunn talked directly with academic vice president Jay Baliff, complaining about the potential story, and Baliff told me my job would be in jeopardy if the article ran. It's that clear. Another example, LDS Church Public Communications said, "We have had no way of fully or finally verifying the accuracy or inaccuracy of current allegations or accounts that are now under challenge." That statement is also not true. The church had already conducted at least two internal inquiries into the veracity of Dunn's storytelling, both spurred by my research. The second time, a church attorney headed the investigation. I cooperated fully with the investigator. His report confirming the allegations was delivered to the Quorum of the Twelve just a couple of weeks before Paul Dunn was given emeritus status. The Arizona Republic thought the Utah media would run with the ball if they got the story rolling. In the facts, Republic reporter Richard Robertson said, "It looks like the issues I was unable to address for lack of space will all eventually come out, and in Salt Lake City, where the debate is the most important." Instead, the Utah media merely parroted the Republic's limited revelations. Sadly, Brother Taylor, I have to tell you that little has changed. If the Utah media failed to accurately tell the story of post-manifesto polygamy, they also wimped out on the Paul Dunn story. The truth is that Paul Dunn's dissembling is far more extensive than media stories reported. My research shows that virtually all of his personal baseball and war stories are unsupported. Perhaps a majority can even be proven outright fabrications. The facts, for example, show Paul Dunn never played in the Cardinal organization, had no professional baseball career, was not part of a special cadre that prepared the way for MacArthur's return to the Philippines, did not miraculously survive a bloody landing during the Guam invasion, and so on and on and on. I was the reporter who uncovered the AFCO fraud. It was that research that led me to investigating Dunn's war and baseball stories. The dark side of Dunn's dishonest behavior lies in the AFCO scandal. My same research methods, which proved he made up war and baseball stories and forced a partial admission, also reveal that Paul Dunn faked his resignation from AFCO, using false documents as proof. His church secretary played a key role in the deception, a fact I told the two apostles investigating Dunn's conduct is especially reprehensible. Dunn lied to the news media, to the LDS Church for his presidency, and to lawyers during sworn depositions in connection with his involvement in AFCO. Dunn may argue he fabricated war stories to make spiritual points, but he lied about his role in AFCO to save his skin. After getting emeritus status, Dunn's high profile continued with his business ventures. Advertisements touted his guided tours to Israel and major league ballparks. The advisory board for tour sponsor Travel Systems, Inc., included church figures like Wendell Ashton, Oscar McConkie Jr., and Elaine Cannon. Dunn also organized a company called Values Institute, which was set up to conduct youth sport camps with famous LDS athletes like Steve Young, Danny White, Wally Joyner, Danny Ainge, Del Murphy, and others. BYU Athletic Director Glenn Tuckett is among the Institute's faculty. Dunn's son-in-law, Gerald Wingett, was president despite entanglement in numerous lawsuits and judgments relating to other failed business ventures. A year ago this month, Values Institute held a clinic at the UVCC campus in Orem. It used the LDS Institute of Religion building on campus for headquarters and classrooms in apparent violation of church policy against using tax-exempt properties for profit-making companies. Meanwhile, Dunn's new business phone answers to American Values Foundation, which, unlike Values Institute, is organized as a nonprofit company. The American Values Foundation, though, refuses to show proof of application for tax-exempt status as required by law. Is truth, as Sam Taylor today asked, an endangered species? You can scratch your head a long time trying to understand the Paul Dunn myth-making and cover-up in terms of truth. But if you think of it in terms of connections, you can easily understand. A person well-established in the Good Old Boy Network, sort of the LDS Leadership Social Business Club, gets every benefit of the doubt. Membership has its privileges. Sam Taylor is an historian and novelist. I'm a journalist. He lives in California. I live in Utah. He served in World War II. I'm Vietnam era. A lot of differences, but the story we tell is the same. Oh, say what is truth. 'Tis the rarest gem that connivers of myth do produce.
We have just a few minutes for questions.
I'm afraid I don't understand your question.
Well, I as he was excommunicated.
Yeah, well, I have read his book.
No,
Yes, I'm aware of that. And I'm afraid I'm not an expert on that particular subject. I'm sorry.
Yes, go ahead.
We have a question. I'm always working on something. Well, I'll tell you, people want to retire and write. Well, I was writing all my life, so what was I going to do when I reached senior citizen? I had to keep on.
We'd like to thank Sam and Lynn for their insights today, and we'll let everybody move on to the next session.